Okay. Well, thanks for inviting me. I feel a little awkward. I missed the morning session. I had a talk in the room next door, and now I feel like I just don't know what other people have said, and I feel a little weird about that because I have a feeling that we're all going to be saying some of the similar things. But we're just going to dive in and see how this goes. I approached this talk by trying to focus on some strengths of soil taxonomy and then maybe probably a few more weaknesses, a lot of weaknesses that I dreamt up. I don't think it's an exhaustive list, but it's the ones that kind of pop into my mind when I work with soil survey and soil taxonomy on a pretty regular basis. So it's just kind of a hodgepodge of ideas that kind of popped in my mind as I was thinking about this. And, you know, it's really easy, me being one, I'm probably one of the people that would say that soil taxonomy probably should be changed. It's easy to say that. And when you really start thinking about it, it is a daunting task to consider. It's a lot of work. And so I fully recognize that. So I'm just going to start off with what I consider some of the strengths of the soil taxonomy system. This is something that just really stuck with me as a student early on in my career. I don't know why, it just awed me, the fact that our classification system tracks this progression of soils that are changing through time and also captures some of the uniqueness of soils at the same time. Not all of these are trending in this progression of development. Some are frozen at a state, others are transitioning through time. But this idea of a flow of soil development over pedologic time really intrigued me. And I think it's a great foundation to base a classification system on. So I thought that was a strength of the system. Another strength that you guys probably have already talked about the system is that it's an incredibly valuable tool for a soil resource inventory, and it's really what's pushed our soil survey forward and maybe what makes it stand out as what I think is the best inventory in the world. Soil taxonomy is one of the least arbitrary systems out there. It is very definitive, and that results in great consistency in classification among the individuals. And if you're doing a nationwide inventory, you need that consistency, right? I think we can all agree on that. And so I think that's one strength, another strength of the system. And then as people were talking about in between sessions here, it has helped the National Cooperative Soil Survey refine our concepts of the soil series, which were very loose and general early on, now are really rooted in measurable and quantifiable soil properties. And so that has, for better or worse, made the understanding of a soil series very, very definitive and clear to those people that understand it. Another strength that I see, the formative elements, and this is kind of obvious, but it certainly isn't obvious to people outside of soil survey. The fact that every little nugget of soil taxonomy conveys meaning to people, I think is really unique way to classify an entity. I always, when I'm giving talks out with the public, I list abruptic Dury Zerauf as this soil, and everyone just laughs at me or glares at me or oogle eyes at me, and I say, this is our system. But then I go there and I dissect every formative element in that taxonomic name. I describe the moisture regime. I describe the central concept behind each formative element, and people are awed. They're wowed. They go, whoa, you've got that much information from that series of elements. And so I think that's a real strength of the system. And for me, I use those formative elements when I'm making maps. These are two examples of how, in the past, I've made some maps. So this, let's see, how does this work? There. This map is showing what I call nutrient management zones. We're essentially trying to use soil taxonomy as an aggregator to repackage soil survey to predict which soils are going to fix potassium, which soils are going to not fix potassium, which soils are naturally high in potassium. So we essentially use taxonomy to repackage soil survey into this map here. That's a great tool for me as a person that's trying to deliver a soil survey-based information in a usable form to the public. And it's not always done by using soil property data. Sometimes the taxonomy is an easier way to use it in a GIS, how we distribute data right now in its current form. This other map is just showing you the distribution of vernal pools. Again, I use soil taxonomy to predict where I might find vernal pools in that region. So for me, it's a very convenient, powerful way to convey conceptual landscape patterns across a region of interest. And the formative elements serve as my aggregating mechanisms. I hope I'm right on this. I don't know. I just pulled this one out of the blue. And I do say it in public, too, so I think I'm right. But, you know, when you're working with soil property data, like organic carbon content, sample size with soil survey, sample size is always going to be an issue, right? We have one representative peton in a soil survey area that's distributing organic carbon or some sort of soil property across the landscape. So we really have a sample size problem there. And what I like to tell people is that that's not as much the case when you're making maps with soil taxonomy, because there's a lot more observations to verify the taxonomic unit while soil surveys are working out in those soil survey areas. And actually, in the, what's it called? Oh, gosh. I don't know. It's not the soil survey manual, but it's another one that they write. It's essentially documenting the approach of soil survey. It's not that one, but I can't remember it. I'll get to it. Come to me by the end of the talk. I looked there first, and it wasn't there. But anyhow, maybe it is there, and I missed it. A minimum of 30 recorded points per soil survey area is needed to document the composition of each map unit. So we have it could be that one, yeah. So you have more validation, more N, when you're working with taxonomy than as opposed to working with soil properties when you're making maps. And I don't know, I'd love feedback with that idea sometime later, but it gives me a little more confidence in the maps that I'm producing, rather than just working with a soil property by itself, if I'm just using soil survey. Okay, so now, those are the strengths. I'm sure there are other strengths that I naively didn't consider, but I'm going to focus now on limitations that I dreamt up. And a lot of the limitations I see are in visualization and map making and using soil survey. First of all, it's not always conducive to making informative maps. This is the Northern Cascade region where I've made a map of soil orders. It conveys a little bit of information about the orders, but land users, managers, they're going to need more information than that. And so, you know, if you're going to work with soil taxonomy, the next progression might be to make a map of suborders. And the problem with suborders is it's a digestible amount of units in the legend, maybe a few too many. But the problem is it doesn't adequately build on the level of soil property information that we might want. We're polluted by moisture regimes and temperature regimes. These are great. I love moisture regimes and temperature regimes. They convey a lot of information to me. But what I really want to know about when I'm making maps is soil properties, inferred or measured when we're classifying the soil. So I feel like I could make a much better map at the suborder level if I had more detail about soil properties at that hierarchical level. Same area, if we make a map of grape groups. Obviously, you can see the constraint here. There's just too many. And in terms of map making, if I used grape group, this is the one that has the detail on soil properties that I might be interested if I'm trying to convey something to a land manager. But there's just so many properties. You have to be a pretty skilled pedologist or a fairly skilled pedologist to aggregate around these grad groups to get to a legend that is usable for the lay person. And so here with great groups, it needs some extra effort. That's not undoable, but ultimately what I hope is that we have a system that's flexible enough that anybody could use it and get at information that they need. So some other limitations. Soil tax does not always build on its central concepts. Here's an example. Alfasols. The layman term definition of an alfasol would be it's a soil with a subsurface alluvial accumulation of clay and a base saturation greater than 50%. That might be the conceptual idea of one. The problem I have is that the suborders and even to some extent the great groups don't focus on expanding the ideas behind that conceptual definition. Why don't we describe in the suborders depth argillic, thickness of the argillic, maybe bands or classes of clay ranges within the argillic, or abruptness in that transition. We tinker at it, we get at it indirectly. The use of paley combines both abruptness and thickness. It could be an either or thing. So it doesn't really separate those out as ways to describe that fundamental idea of the subsurface accumulation of clay. So personally, I'd like to see that followed through with more in a taxonomy. And this is kind of going further on that point. Here's a picture of a bunch of typic haplozeralphs in California. Man, I love to make maps at the great group level, but wow, look at all that variability. I mean, that's insane. And you lose that. As soon as you make that into a map, man, it's gold stamped. Everyone is saying that's what that soil is doing. But when you really look at the data closely or the soils carefully, you're seeing a huge, huge variability. So you've got to really be careful with that. And I think part of the problem is I've kind of artificially created this problem. Typic haplozeralphs. I mean, that means nothing. Where it's a typic haplozeralph central to an alfasol with a Mediterranean climate. It's not giving us more information. And when you look at, this is a map or a graph showing the frequency of xeralphs mapped from 100% to zero. And these are the different great groups of xeralphs. And what you see is almost 80% of the xeralphs are typic, or sorry, haplozeralphs in California. So we're seeing this huge body of soils where we're really not getting a lot of information from them, besides the fact that, you know, they have an alluvial clay increase and about 50% base saturation or higher. So there would be, we could learn so much more by maybe discretizing or breaking up that group and understanding it in a way that's more relative to its conditions. Other limitations. This is a big one, in my opinion, and this is probably the huge one, is that it's poorly understood outside of NCSS, soil taxonomy. Nobody gets it, all right? Even people, you know, in our discipline of soil science don't get it, all right? It's just pedologists and inventory, soil mappers, and maybe a few consultants. The rest of the population doesn't care, and probably never will, maybe, unless we make it more transparent, make it more penetrable. We can't rely on informing the population by teaching a soil genesis and classification class in a land-grant institution. You know, those days are gone. Those classes are dwindling. The students are losing interest in that. We're moving in different directions. So we can't rely on teaching this to let people understand this language. We need to find innovative ways to let people discover soil taxonomy on their own, and they can. It just means that we have to think about it differently and go about it differently. I don't even know what a thapto-histic fluvoquint. I know what part of it is, but I don't know what thapto is. So, you know, to illustrate this point, I did a survey of our grad students, our soils and biogeochemistry graduate students at UC Davis. I think all of them had a class, at least a summer class, where we describe soils and classify them to the family level. So they know the soil taxonomy. And I picked a soil that I thought they might recognize or maybe some formative elements, and I asked them to just give me a layman's definition of what that soil is all about. So I asked them to tell me what a pachyc palaeozoal is. And I asked them first to tell me what a mollisol is, second what a zerol is, then a palaeozoal, then what is a pachyc palaeozoal. So I'm trying to get at their understanding of these formative elements. And I think about 20 people responded. And what you see here is that green means that they got it right, yellow partially right, red wrong, and purple they didn't know or they didn't remember. And what you see is most students who've had this soil classification class understand what a mollisol is and understand what a zerol is, although some are getting it wrong. But when we get into the palaeozerols, or what palae means or what pachyc means, very few people understood. The minority understood what it meant. And more often than not, they didn't know or got it wrong. And so where all the detail is, where all the interesting stuff is, what I'd argue is the kind of the pachyc and the palae, that stuff is being lost by students. It's not being retained. So why aren't people sticking with soil taxonomy? Why don't they have the passion to understand it like we do? You know, there's a variety of reasons. It might be too difficult to classify soils. I mean, we have students out there, 100 degrees, 108 degrees, sweating bullets, just like this fellow here, trying to read keys to soil taxonomy, and it's a giant turnoff, right? It's mind-boggling. Even myself, I sometimes just shake my head and say, oh, I give up. I'm going to call it a haplozerol. No, I don't do that. But time, you know, the time it takes to get to your answer is something I think that students lose, they just give up on. The expense is another thing. To really get it right, you need to do the lab work for some soils more than others. And to me, that's a problem if we want this to be widely adopted, widely used. We got to make it easier, we got to make it cheaper. Maybe it's a little bit too quantitative when you read some of those things in soil taxonomy. I mean, I like the fact that we're based on measurable properties, but in some instances, that level of quantitation is so hard to digest that it just people just tune out, move on, and don't get interested. Another thing has probably been mentioned before is it changes too often. This is an excuse for people to give up. You know, if soil taxonomy is changing every 2 years, people are just going to tune out pretty soon and not invest in terms of relearning it. So it's expensive for everyone. And so I think it would be better to let's change it once and divert that effort into training people to understand it when we do refine it, if we do. So I'll just end with some kind of similar bullet point recommendations, some I probably already touched on. Let's refine it one more time, and that could take a while, and let's leave it alone for about 10, 15 years. That might be hard, because usually when you refine something, there's lots of gaps that you recognize. So maybe we refine it two more times, I don't know. But if we do change it, let's let it sit for a while, see if that helps. Another thing to do that I think would be create greater adoption is to consider other classification systems to parallel soil taxonomy that might be more interesting to other disciplines, ecologists, hydrologists, land managers. At one point, I wanted to develop a kind of land use-based soil taxonomy system based on use rather than soil properties, and I thought that was a great idea. Until I tried to think about how to do it, and then I couldn't come up with anything. It was just too hard. I just started, you know, long lists of conditions and properties to consider, so it really is hard. But there's no reason why we can't develop classification systems, almost interpretations, multiple interpretations, focus more energy on interpretations, so the end users can see the value in our system more. More direct emphasis on communicating processes and ecosystem services. Is there a way to more clearly blend recharge, discharge, runoff, through flow, resilience to change, erosion, fertility, carbon sequestration? Can we build those concepts more robustly into a revised form of taxonomy? I think that would certainly gather more interest in the academic communities. Tools to enable users to interact with the data in the way they want to. I still think like we're stuck in our way of just putting things on paper and allowing people to read and interpret the information we produce. But this generation, they are very different human beings. They want to get the data, they want to use the data the way they want to use it in creative ways that they've figured out. Sometimes that's going to be wrong, but sometimes it's going to be something new and very interesting. So I think we need to enable these people to make these failures and discoveries on their own rather than telling them exactly how to use it. And this is just one example where we tried to model the character of a soil by clay, cation exchange capacity, depth, pH, and maximum salinity. And we just put it in a numerical classification system, and this is what we got. We got a map. And you can see how those classes vary within the 1 through 5 on that map. I don't know what that map means, really, but it has some interesting trends, right? And so it kind of occurred to me that, wow, people could start, if we could give them the tool, the infrastructure to build these things, and just say, I want to see this, this, and this, let's see how it classifies, a lot of interesting things might bubble up. This isn't a replacement of soil taxonomy, it's more of a parallel of it, I guess. Focus on tools to visualize similarity among taxa. This is stuff that we do for the series, but I see no reason why we can't start doing this for the different hierarchical levels of soil taxonomy, where we're looking at depth profiles of properties across different taxa. We're showing the confidence intervals, so people can kind of visualize the variability in soil properties across different taxa. I think that's important so people can actually really understand what they're interpreting and what they might be mapping or using. This is another way to look at soil properties where you have probability across the x-axis, depth across the y, different horizons in color-coded lines. So you can start to visualize how these horizons are differing among many soils. With genetic horizon sequence. So we could do that in a different ways and different approaches with soil taxonomy to get people interested, to delve more into the different classes. Because I think that's part of the problem is people just aren't peeking up. Just about 1 minute?
Yep.
I'm almost done. Okay. Finally, clarify and identify links between taxa and geomorphology. Again, we're stuck on these papers, these maps. We need to establish linkages between the geomorphic position of taxa and different taxonomic units that are being mapped in the field. And we need to show those linkages in different ways so that people can understand it. I'll just skip this one. So I think I'm out of time. But this is just a way to show series extent in the United States. Why don't we do this for different taxa too? I think we just need to get more people involved, and then there might be more momentum to adopt this as a meaningful language beyond just pedologists. So I got any questions?